Well, thank you, Matt. It's good to see everybody out on this cold winter day. And a howdy to those out listening on the webcast. I hope you're in warm and cozy. Seems like winter just doesn't want to let go. And I had to laugh. John Miller last week was talking about Randy Stiver and the two services that we had canceled due to inclement weather. And I think some of you may know or may not know, there was also a gentleman that was scheduled to speak on both of those days. And that was our very own Ray Murdoch. So I don't know whether to blame Randy or Ray for those snow days. But I will tell you this, I see Ray is going to be speaking to us here in the next few weeks, so I'm not putting my snow shovel away quite yet. Somebody told me a cute story this week on God answering prayer, and I thought I'd share it with you. There was a lady out shopping, driving around and shopping, and her daughter called and said that she wasn't feeling well and asked her if she would stop by the pharmacy and pick her up some medicine. And the mother said, sure, I'll do that. So she went in, came out, found she had locked her keys in her car. So she found a rusty coat hanger and was hard at it trying to get her door unlocked when this burly biker came up, who had the beard and the tattoos, and said, lady, it looks like you're having problems. And she explained the situation. Within 60 seconds, he had the car door open. So she gave him a big hug and said, God, thank you for sending me such a nice gentleman. And he kind of pushed back and he says, lady, he says, I'm not really a nice guy. He said, in fact, I just got released from prison a couple days ago. I was in prison for car theft. At which point, the lady gave him another big hug and said, God, thank you for sending me a professional. So, God truly does answer our prayers. Sometimes, and I know we've all been through it, sometimes ways we wouldn't have thought they'd been answered, but he always does. Well, brethren, today, I'd like to say I doubt there is anybody that's listening to this message that wouldn't agree that this nation has been blessed by God. We know we've been blessed monetarily. We've been blessed with knowledge and innovation. And we have been blessed with power on a world stage. But have we as a nation always turned to God to ask for his guidance, for his direction? We know our forefathers did. But do we still do that today? Or have we formulated our own view on how this nation, this society should operate? There are many missteps that we have taken in our attempts in incorporating our own human knowledge instead of following God. And today I'd like to take a look at some of the wrong paths that we have taken. I'm going to throw a name out today. And I'm curious to know if anybody has heard of this gentleman. And don't feel bad, because up until a few weeks ago, I had never heard his name either. The name is William John Henry Boettcher. Has anybody heard that name? I'm glad all the hands didn't go up, because I'd feel foolish. No, I had not heard of the gentleman before. And I was introduced to Mr. Boettcher, if you will, by listening to Glenn Beck. I'll just read his bio here that I found on Wikipedia. William John Henry Boettcher was born in 1873 in Hamburg, Germany. He was ordained a Presbyterian minister soon after his arrival in the United States as a young adult. He was ordained in Brooklyn, New York. He quickly gained attention as an eloquent, motivational speaker and is often regarded today as the forerunner of such contemporary success coaches as Anthony Robbins. Mr. Boettcher was a political conservative, and you may have heard he is probably most known for two pamphlets that he authored. One of them is called The Ten Cannots, and the other one is entitled The Seven National Crimes. Today I'm going to probably concentrate more on the seven national crimes, but I'm going to take a few minutes to introduce you to the Ten Cannots. And so kind of you can get a flavor of what Mr. Boettcher's thoughts are. You may have heard about the Ten Cannots, and usually they are attributed to Abraham Lincoln. But they were not. This is incorrect. They were actually penned by Mr. Boettcher. And the reason for the confusion, in 1943, the Committee for Constitutional Government created a leaflet entitled Lincoln on Limitations. On one side of the pamphlet, there were quotes by Lincoln, and on the other side were the Ten Cannots by Mr. Boettcher. So hence the misunderstanding that the Ten Cannots were actually penned by Mr. Lincoln. They were not. And the Ten Cannots are as follows. The first one, you cannot bring about prosperity by discouraging thrift. And if you want to put that into a positive statement, you can bring about prosperity by encouraging thrift. You know, sometimes we think of thrift as being cheap, and that's not actually what thrift means. Thrift actually means that we manage our money or our income to eliminate any waste. Since this was a political statement by Mr. Boettcher, I want to ask the question, does our country practice thrift? Do we actually manage our income in this country to eliminate waste? I think we all know the answer to that, and the answer would be no. I travel a lot of miles for work. I could go out and buy the cheapest car I could find and hope that it would hold together for 90,000 miles. Or would I be better off if I invested a little more money, bought a better car, and hopefully get maybe 300,000 miles out of it? So thrift isn't always about the cheapest. I want to ask the question, how many times has the Bible instructed us to be good stewards of what God has given us? And prosperity and thrift, I think we all know, just doesn't refer to money. Let's turn over, if you will, to 1 Peter. 1 Peter, and we're going to be in chapter 4. First Peter chapter 4, and we're going to look at verse 10. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If we are good stewards of what God has given us, we are to manage what he has given us and don't waste it. And part of that is that we share it with others. Now, the next four cannots I'm going to lump together. And they are as follows. You cannot strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. You cannot help little men by tearing down big men. You cannot lift the wage earner by pulling down the wage payer. You cannot help the poor by destroying the rich. What's this about? It's about class warfare. And we hear it almost every day in this country. The rich need to pay their fair share. We need equality. When in fact, the top wage earners, the top 50% of the wage earners in this country pay almost 99% of the entire tax burden. And yet our politicians want more. Now, the wage earners have been on attack for decades. And yet, the percentage of those living in poverty today has not changed. It's the same as it was 50 years ago. Destroying the wealth or the wealthy will not diminish the poor. Can we read anywhere in the Bible that God has told us that it is bad to be wealthy? Actually, quite the opposite. There are blessings for being obedient to God. If we want to look at some people in the Bible, look at Job, Lot, Abraham, David, many others. They were blessed with a wealthy existence. And if we look at it, not only monetarily, but they were blessed with family, health, and longevity. Being wealthy is not a crime or a sin. And as we all know, what is a sin is if that pursuit of wealth interferes with living a godly lifestyle. We all know 1 Timothy 6:10, where it says, the love of money is the root of evil things. The love of that money is the root of evil things. If we put that money before anything else in our lives, that's what is wrong. And being wealthy has its responsibilities. We are to take care of the less fortunate. Those of us that have been blessed have that responsibility that we need to look out for others. But we don't need to do it through a third party. And that third party would be the government. And you might ask, can somebody be wealthy without following God? And I think we see that all the time. So absolutely they can be. But personally, I'm not going to show disdain for all the wealthy, not knowing if God is working in their life or not. God knows, and the rewards will be appropriate. The next cannot. You cannot establish sound security on borrowed money. I think we all know where we're going, over to Proverbs. If you would, turn with me to Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22, and we'll look at verse 7. Very simple. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is a servant to the lender. I don't think I can add anything more to that. You are a servant to the lender if you borrow money. Pretty plain. The next cannot. You cannot further the brotherhood of men by inciting class hatred. And I would like to add to that, by inciting racial hatred. And we've been trying for decades to heal the racial rifts in this country. But quite frankly, the politicians won't let us. They keep it in the forefront of their comments, and we find in a lot of cases it's merely to secure their power base. The next cannot. Oh boy, I love this one. You cannot keep out of trouble by spending more than you earn. Today, credit cards, I don't know how many mailings I get every week asking for me to get a new credit card. There's easy loans available. I know things have tightened up a little bit. But all of this easy money, the credit cards, the borrowing is all lends or can lend our personal downfall. And if I could only add two other words to this, I'd say the federal government. And wow, look at the mess we're in, how much we're in debt. We're talking at least decades and decades to bail ourselves out, even if we didn't borrow any more money, but we continue to do it. And quite frankly, and we've discussed this in the past, it probably will be our downfall. The next cannot. You cannot build character and courage by destroying men's initiative and independence. You know, a lot of times we talk about everything being equal in this country, and sometimes I think the country is trying to make us into one homogenous blob. And I know we've seen examples of it in our school systems where they want to give medals to anybody that participates in a sport, whether they've one or not. We all know that a lot of the graduates coming out, they've got their diploma, but unfortunately a lot of them can't even read. And that's sad. So in this country, like I say, we're trying to make it more of a homogenous blob, and if anybody happens to step out of that box and excel, then a lot of times we look at ways to bring that back down to earth. And I guess I have to ask the question, did God make us robots? And did he force us to follow his ways? No, he gave us free will to follow him and to excel. The last cannot. You cannot help men permanently by doing for them what they can and should do for themselves. It kind of brings to mind the old adage, give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. Teach him to fish and he'll be good for the rest of his life. And we look at the welfare state. I'll stand up here and say, and we all agree, that there is definitely a need to help those that cannot help themselves. But the waste, the fraud, and the abuse has become ludicrous. And we know in a lot of cases it's not a hand up anymore, that it's a lifestyle. Now, Mr. Betker penned this in 1916. And he died in 1962. And if he were alive today, what do you think he'd say about what he had written? I'm sure there'd be an I told you so in there somewhere. And if you think about the time frame that he penned this, was nowhere near what things are like today. So that gives you a little flavor on where he's coming from a conservative bent. And that was the Ten Cannots. And I'd like to talk now about the seven national crimes. We call them national crimes, but as we go through here, you're going to see that these will apply to us as individuals. And we're thinking of crimes. I know a lot of times we think probably of something sinister or wrong, but I'm going to read the seven national crimes to you, and then we'll discuss them individually. The seven national crimes that Mr. Betker talked about. I don't think, I don't know, I don't care, I am too busy, I leave well enough alone, I have no time to read and find out, and the last one, I am not interested. I don't think. It's a simple process. We use our brains to disseminate information and come to some type of logical conclusion. From a political or national standpoint, do most people ponder about what to do or decisions they are about to make, or do they just react? Or worse yet, are spoon-fed information from somebody else? Do they make decisions from 30-second sound bites, and we see this a lot today, curb appeal? We take our information from somebody that looks appealing. Again, what about us as Christians? And I'll ask the same question. Did God make us robots and spoon feeds us what we should know? And the answer obviously is no. He gave us free will to make our own decisions, to think, to ponder, and to make those decisions. What word do we think about when we think about God? And it's probably meditation. Let's turn over to Joshua. Right there after Deuteronomy. We're going to be in Joshua 1. In Joshua 1, and we're going to look at verse 8. Joshua 1, verse 8. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. You know, it says to be in constant meditation. And obviously, we can't sit 24 hours a day in a corner and meditate all the time. And, you know, we do have to meditate. We can always, however, turn to God's Word to think what we are about to do. And we should do that when something comes up. We should stop, even if for a couple seconds, and think about what God has to say to us. What God would have us do. And if we take the words literally here, when we do that, We'll have success. We'll have prosperity. The next one, the next crime, I don't know. From a national or I guess a political standpoint, do most people in this country really know what's going on around them? We see on some of the comedy shows the man in the street segments where people are asked questions and some of the ludicrous answers they give. If we ask somebody today who's the vice president, who's the Speaker of the House, who's the Senate Majority Leader, who's Secretary of State, a very, very high percentage don't know the answer to those simple questions. And they have very little knowledge about what any of the legislation that we go through means in their lives. Again, they are spoon-fed information in 30-second sound bites. What about us as Christians? Is knowledge important? I know I represent a polymer company that I'm a sales manager for, and I'm occasionally asked a question that I don't know the answer to. And I respond, I don't know. But the difference is, I'm surely going to find the answer. Is the knowledge we learn every Sabbath, that we learn from our Bible studies, that we learn from our own study important? We all know it is. Turn with me, if you would please, over to Hosea. Verse 4. Hosea, verse 4, and we're going to look at verse 6. We've probably read it many times. Hosea, verse 4, or chapter 4, verse 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being priest for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. That sounds pretty important to me. Pretty bold statement that knowledge is important. Another example, Ephesians 3. Ephesians 3 and 19. Ephesians 3 and 19. To know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. It's a nice statement that knowledge allows us to be filled with the fullness of God. One more, Psalms 139. Find it here. 139. And we're going to start out in verse 1. A little different approach to knowledge here, but I think it's appropriate. It says, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. Verse 2, you understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down. You are and acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. Verse 5, you have hedged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, and I cannot attain it. You know, when I read this, if God takes the time to have intimate knowledge of us as individuals, shouldn't we take the time to know God? The next one, I don't care. And we could kind of interpret this in two different ways. I guess I looked at it as either apathy or compassion. And if you look at it from the apathy standpoint, are most people in this country really concerned about what's going on, or are they just content to get their goodies and be left alone? when they don't know, is there a true desire to find out? I know Jimmy Buffett did a song one time that says, I don't know and I don't care. And sometimes that sounds a lot like this country. If you look at it on the compassion side, most people give lip service to compassion. But do they really serve? Do they really give? If the question is asked, should we really help the poor? A resounding yes will arise. But it will probably be tempered with, not my money, not my time. That's for the rich. That's for the other guy. So what about us as Christians? If we look at apathy, we all know apathy is a terrible thing. Just ask the Laodiceans. When I'm asked that job question that I don't know the answer to, one of two things can happen. I can say I don't care and leave it at that, or I can find out. And I know as Christians, we will confront a lot of situations that we simply cannot find a way out of or struggle for the right decision. And again, we can say, I don't care, or we can dig in. On the compassion side, is compassion important to us as Christians? We've heard numerous sermons on this in the past, and we've had wonderful messages addressing compassion. And we ask, is it a part of God's nature? Is it a part of Christ's nature? And should it be part of ours? I'm going to list some scriptures here, and you don't have to turn to them, but I just want to show you the importance, and we all know the importance, of compassion as the Bible would direct us. Numerous scriptures here. If we look at God's compassion, Deuteronomy 32:36 says God has compassion on his servants. You can jot these down if you want to. Psalm 78:38, God was full of compassion and forgave their iniquity. Psalms 86:15, God is full of compassion, gracious, merciful, truthful, long-suffering. Jeremiah 12, verse 5, God has compassion on them, meaning Israel, and he'll bring them back. Lamentations 3:22, Israel not consumed because of God's compassion. The last one, James 5, verse 11, the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. And if we look at it, quite frankly, brethren, where would we all be without God's compassion? If we look at Christ's compassion, Matthew 9:36, Christ was moved with compassion as he saw the multitudes. Mark 8, verse 2, Christ had compassion on the multitudes. One of our favorites, Hebrews 4:15. Talks about our compassionate high priest who was tempted as we are. And to one another, Zechariah 7:9, show mercy and compassion to your brother. 1 Peter, in fact, let's turn there. 1 Peter 3. We're going to look at verses 8 and 9. I think this spells it out. Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. Some beautiful words. So I think we can see that compassion is important. The Bible talks about it continually. So I don't care is a national crime. The next one, I am too busy. Are we as a nation too busy to be involved? As long as we have our pleasurable distractions, is everything okay? And are our elected leaders really too busy to listen to what their constituents have to say? You know, we've heard numerous, again, sermons talking about the cares of this world getting in the way of our study and our involvement with God. And there's not much more I can add to that. We've heard it a lot, other than to say, and we all know, we do need to set our priorities. The next national crime, I leave well enough alone. There's a well-known saying, and I know you've all heard it, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. If we look from a historical standpoint, ask the Jews in Europe if this was the case. You know, a lot of the world knew what was going on at that time, but they didn't want to get involved. They left well enough alone. And the Bible tells us that we really should confront our problems. We should not leave well enough alone. If we turn over to Matthew 18, it gives us some directions. Matthew 18. We're going to look at verses 15 through 17. Matthew 18, starting in verse 15. We all know these. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear you, take with you two or more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even then to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Pretty simple. We should not leave well enough alone. There are guidelines that we should confront problems, that we shouldn't just ignore them. And it is important that we just don't sit back and not take action. I have no time to read and find out is the next one. It's kind of funny, but we know today if something isn't on TV, if it isn't in a song, if it isn't on an iPad or in a text message, it doesn't seem to exist. We have thousands and thousands of years of written history for our learning, and yet sometimes it's not important. History that would allow us not to make the same mistakes over and over again. But yet we never seem to have time for this knowledge. And for us as Christians, we all know how important it is to study and learn. Let's take a look at that over in Proverbs. I'll look in Proverbs 1. We'll start out in verse 20. Proverbs 1, verse 20. We're going to read down to verse 33, but let's start out in 20. Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief cornerstones. At the opening of the gates in the city, she speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn at my reproof. Surely I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. Because I have called and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my reproof, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes. When your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me. But I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, and they will not find me, because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would have none of my counsel and despised all my reproof. Therefore they shall eat the fruit of their own way and will be filled to the full with their own fancies. For the turning away of the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without fear or evil. Knowledge is important. It's there for us. It's there for us in many forms. We have no excuse when we're confronted with situations when we don't know the answers to. We need to take the time to read and find out. And again, that can include the Bible, the Bible's on the internet. We've got a multitude of resources. The last sin here, or crime, is I am not interested. And I would say probably the most scornful of all human traits, and that is complacency or indifference. And it has been the downfall of societies for millennia. And we know that it's going on in our country today. Just give me enough to be comfortable and leave me alone. And God hates complacency. Let's look at that over in Zephaniah. Right, pretty close before the New Testament, Zephaniah 1. Zephaniah 1, we'll look at verse 12. And it says, "And it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps and punish the men who are settled in complacency, who say in their heart, the Lord will not do good, nor will he do evil." God despises complacency. I mean, we look at what God said about the Laodiceans. And they were complacent. They were neither hot nor cold. And he was going to spew them out, or as the rendering says, vomit them out. It wasn't pretty. He does not like complacency. And if you think about it, God can work with the wicked if they are willing to change. And he can work with the righteous. But if you're complacent, or you're indifferent, or you're not interested, how can God work with you? There's no way that God can reach you. So God hates complacency. Brethren, these two simple pamphlets were written by a simple minister almost 100 years ago. But how resounding are they today to us as a country and as individuals? Truth transcends time, and God's truth is timeless.